The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
Can you help me, please? I've had a problem with my health for years and I can't get to the bottom of it. The doctors have run out of ideas.
I'd love to help. My name is Kevin Davis. Our bioresonance system starts with an automated full body scan. It's simply the quickest way to shine a light on what's going on inside, with treatments during the same session.
Right, can you book me in, please?
For the latest health tech at the best price, visit biohealthtech.co.uk today and make us your first choice for a healthier you.
If only I'd found out about you sooner, it would have made so much difference.
You're listening to UK Health Radio. Welcome to the Therapy Suite. I'm Duncan Ellison, a therapeutic counsellor promoting positive mental health. This week in the headlines, should businesses employ mental health first aiders? And should ketamine be prescribed as a nasal spray for those suffering with mental health issues? These stories and more coming up. Music on the way from Paolo Nutini and James, and wise words to reflect on. So if good mental health matters to you, then this show is not to be missed. Join me, Duncan Ellison, as we open the doors to the Therapy Suite, only on UK Health Radio. Let's start with the mental health news making the headlines this week. A solicitor in Leeds has launched a campaign to encourage employers to provide mental health first aiders for their staff. Jodie Hill has posted a petition on change.org calling for the law to be amended so that it would be mandatory to appoint mental health first aiders in the same way as physical responders. Her petition says, training a member of staff in mental health first aid can help ensure that there is somebody in the office who can recognise the signs of mental ill health as soon as an employee develops them. Having someone in the office trained in mental health first aid also helps to remove the stigma surrounding the subject and creates an open environment for those who are suffering to open up. Hill stressed that there is legislation requiring physical first aiders in the workplace, but nothing for mental health, despite the fact it's one of the biggest costs to UK businesses. Also in the news, a nasal spray containing ketamine, a powerful general anaesthetic, has shown promise in treating symptoms of severe depression and suicidal thoughts, according to a new study. The Royal College of Psychiatrists told the BBC it was a significant study that brought the drug one step closer to being prescribed on the NHS. Researchers said the results of the study support nasal spray as a possible effective rapid treatment for patients who are deemed at imminent risk for suicide. They said it could be an important treatment to bridge the gap that exists because of the delayed effect of most common antidepressants, which can take 4 to 6 weeks to become fully effective. That said, researchers believe more exploration is needed into the potential for abuse of ketamine. The study was a proof of concept, and the nasal spray must still go through a further study before possible approval before public use. At the moment, it remains unclear whether ketamine nasal sprays can be safely relied upon as a treatment for patients with severe depression. 9 out of 10 teachers have suffered high levels of job-related stress, a recent report has revealed. This follows a recent study into what is required to ensure ongoing student success rates. The results are much higher than previously thought and questions the mental health resources available to teachers. Classrooms with highly stressed teachers tend to have the poorest student outcomes, such as lower exam grades and frequent behavioural problems. Authors of the research have suggested that better access is needed to mental health screening, avoiding the need for additional teaching support, further stress and ultimately burnout. They say positive action will help teachers to manage their mental health, allowing them to concentrate on developing and mentoring young people in the classroom. Finally, research published this month has revealed new clues which might explain why young people with the most severe forms of antisocial behaviour struggle to control and regulate their emotions and might be more susceptible to developing anxiety or depression as a result. The study used neuroimaging methods to investigate young people with the condition conduct disorder, typified by symptoms that range from lying and truancy through to physical violence. Researchers from the University of Bath, Cambridge and California Institute of Technology wanted to understand more about the wiring of the brain in adolescents with conduct disorder and link connectivity to the severity of the condition and psychopathic traits. The team used to define deficits in guilt, remorse, and empathy. Dr. Graham Fairchild from the Department of Psychology at the University of Bath explained, "These results may suggest why young people with conduct disorder but without psychopathic traits find it difficult to control their emotions, especially strong negative emotions like anger." Interesting stories making the headlines this week. We've heard a lot recently about mental health first aiders and the positive impact they can have in the workplace. We heard in the news that Jodie Hill, a solicitor in Leeds, has launched a campaign to encourage employers to provide mental health first aiders for their staff, calling for the law to be amended so that it would be mandatory to appoint mental health first aiders in the same way as physical responders. We all know and understand the importance of having qualified first aiders in the workplace, and I think many people would make the connection to St John's Ambulance for this kind of training. In fact, St John also provide the mental health training that Jodie is currently fighting for. St John Ambulance is working in conjunction with Mental Health First Aid England to provide mental health courses which will help raise awareness of mental health illnesses, enabling people to support themselves and others to aid recovery. The courses are designed to reduce stigma through education and to increase the provision of care for those who have mental illnesses. Here's what St John's has published on their website. "Workplace mental health training has been proven to make a lasting difference in people's knowledge and confidence around mental health. Thanks to the development of mental health first aid training courses, responsible employers now have the opportunity to address the key issue of ignorance about mental health in the workplace. Those that choose to do so are likely to improve the workplace for their staff and have a positive impact on business profitability. Employers have a legal duty of care to ensure that employees are provided with a safe working environment and must take reasonable care to prevent personal injury, including mental and physical harm that may arise in the workplace. Someone with poor mental health may not realise, and even if they do, they may be reluctant to seek help or may not know where to turn for care. In the workplace, there's still a great deal of ignorance around mental health issues, including uncertainty about how to recognise mental health illnesses and uncertainty about how to react when faced with it. This means that those in need of mental health help and support don't get the help they need. When left uninformed, managers and co-workers may unwittingly exhibit stigmatising behaviours which can be detrimental to a person experiencing a mental health issue. Furthermore, by failing to respond appropriately to an employee with a mental health issue, an organisation may open itself to a claim for compensation. This could be lengthy, expensive, and take precious time away from managers and staff. Like Jodie, I'm in total support of having qualified mental health first aiders in the workplace. And if you think you could fill that role, check out the St John's Ambulance website at www.sja.org.uk. That's www.sja.org.uk. Here's a story which may divide people's opinions. We heard earlier about plans to provide ketamine, a powerful general anaesthetic which has shown promise as a nasal spray for treating symptoms of severe depression and suicidal thoughts, according to a new study. The Royal College of Psychiatrists told the BBC it was a significant study that brought the drug one step closer to being prescribed on the NHS. Ketamine is a pretty serious tool and open to widespread abuse. It's also referred to as a date rape drug and is common amongst drug users who seek the detached high it can provide. Similar to LSD, ketamine's effects are varied and unpredictable. It can induce euphoria, but in some cases the hallucinations it causes can become extremely frightening. Mixing the drug with other depressants like alcohol and heroin intensifies the dangers of respiratory depression, which can be deadly. But, and it's a big but, if it's used in a controlled manner, will it be a problem? To be clear, it is my understanding that ketamine is not yet approved as a drug suitable for treating mental health conditions. That said, there's positive evidence to suggest it could be used as a rapid-acting antidepressant suitable for those experiencing bipolar a major depressive disorder. Initial tests have been quite surprising, indicating that the drug has a rapid response time, in fact, within 2 hours, and a sustained period lasting between 1 and 2 weeks. If this is the case, it could be a real breakthrough for people struggling with mental health issues. Controversial, I know. Be good to hear your views on this subject. You can email me at duncan@thinkduncan.com, or you can reach me on Twitter at duncan_Ellison. You're listening to The Therapy Suite, only on UK Health Radio. This time of year, parents of children of all ages are encouraging more revision ahead of what is a time for annual exams, whether SATs, GCSEs or A-levels. You'd be right to worry about your child experiencing burnout and the consequences of stress and anxiety. But it's not just the parents, and indeed children, who are worrying. Thousands of teachers are under so much pressure, they're simply burning out. Many who have only just qualified are resigned to the fact that teaching is not the career they dreamed of. It's no secret that teaching is a stressful profession. However, when stress interferes with personal and emotional well-being at such a severe level, the relationship teachers have with students is more likely to suffer, much like any relationship would in a high-stress environment. We heard in the news that as many as 9 out of 10 teachers have suffered high levels of job-related stress. This follows a recent study into what is required to ensure ongoing student success rates. The results are, sadly, much higher than previously thought, and questions the mental health resources available to teachers. Almost 3/4 of teachers say the Year 2 test regime is detrimental to teachers' mental health. And the proportion rises to 9 in 10 teachers for Year 6 SATs, according to a joint TES and NEU Teaching Union survey, which asked 500 teachers about the impact of primary testing regimes. And some experts believe this could help explain the decline in student-teacher enrolment and mental health existing in teaching staff. Brian Apter, chair of the Division of Education and Child Psychologists at the British Psychological Society, said, "Key Stage 1 SATs are terribly unpopular with teachers." And teachers have commented, "People don't want to teach in particularly year groups because they are really stressful." According to a recent poll of school staff, teachers and pupils with mental health care needs are being let down by the education system. Almost 60% of respondents said a mental health crisis has taken hold in schools, fueled by changes to exams and the curriculum. Around half of respondents said changes to GCSE and A-levels and to the school curriculum were exacerbating mental health problems. Most felt that the current school system fails to give teachers with mental health care needs the right support. And even a greater proportion said the same is true for pupils. The survey also showed a widely held belief that the Department for Education fails to understand the scale of mental health problems gripping the school system. This is an interesting topic to discuss. Whilst teaching, I have no doubt, is a very stressful job, let's not forget the hundreds of other careers that are also suffering from the pressures of modern-day targets. What's your thoughts on this? Finally, why is it that some young people find it difficult to control their emotions? You could put it down to hormones and physical changes, or it could be a condition called conduct disorder. The condition is a serious behavioural and emotional disorder that can occur in children and teens. And a child with this disorder may display patterns of disruptive and violent behaviour and have problems following rules. It's not uncommon for children and teens to have behaviour-related problems at some time during their development. However, the behaviour is considered to be a conduct disorder when it's long-lasting and when it violates the rights of others, goes against accepted norms of behaviour, and disrupts the child's family and everyday life. We heard in the news about new research which has been conducted here in the UK and over in the States, which has revealed new clues which might explain why young people with the most severe forms of antisocial behaviour struggle to control and regulate their emotions, and ultimately might be more susceptible to developing anxiety or depression as a result. Researchers found that youths with conduct disorder showed significantly low responses to angry and sad faces. The parts of the brain which are normally involved in emotion appear less able to function in the youths with the condition. Over time, this could lead to them developing mental health problems such as depression or anxiety, whereas youths with psychopathic traits might be protected from developing such problems. According to the researchers, the study shows that there may be important differences between youths with high and low levels of psychopathic traits, particularly in the way that the brain is wired. And the findings could have clinical implications on the effectiveness of psychological treatments. So let's take a look at the symptoms of conduct disorder. Symptoms vary depending on the age of the child and whether the disorder is mild, moderate, or severe. In general, symptoms of conduct disorder fall into four general categories. The first is aggressive behaviour. These are behaviours that threaten or cause physical harm and may include fighting, bullying, being cruel to others or animals, using weapons, and forcing others into sexual activity. Destructive behaviour, and this involves intentional destruction of property such as arson and vandalism. Deceitful behaviour, this may include repeated lying, shoplifting, or breaking into homes or cars in order to steal. And finally, violation of rules. This involves going against accepted rules of society or engaging in behaviour that is not appropriate for the person's age. These behaviours may include running away, skipping school, playing pranks, or being sexually active at a very early age. In addition, many children with conduct disorder are irritable, have low self-esteem, and tend to throw frequent temper tantrums. Some may also abuse drugs and alcohol. Children with conduct disorder often are unable to appreciate how their behaviour can hurt others and generally have little guilt or remorse about hurting others. The researchers are currently running a large-scale European study investigating sex differences in antisocial behaviour to investigate whether boys and girls with conduct disorder show similar or different brain abnormalities relative to typical developing boys and girls. Interesting stuff, I hope you'll agree. Plenty more on the way this hour on UK Health Radio. In the meantime, enjoy this from Paolo Nutini.
I was perched outside in the pouring rain, trying to make myself a sail. Then I'll float to you, my darling, with the evening on my tail. Although not the most honest means of travel, it gets me there nonetheless. I'm a heartless man at worst, babe, and a helpless one at best. Darling, I'll bathe your skin, I'll even wash your clothes. Just give me some candy before I go. Oh, darling, I'll kiss your eyes. After my hug, oh, I'm often found explaining, but the hurt lays out all the same. And although I'm left defeated, it gets held against my name. I know you got plenty to offer, baby, but I guess I've taken quite enough. Well, I'm some stain there on your bed sheet. You're my diamond in the rough. Darling, I'll bathe your skin, I'll even wash your clothes. Just give me some candy before I go. After my hug, darling, I'll bathe your skin, I'll even wash your clothes. Just give me some candy before I go. Oh, darling, I'll kiss your eyes and lay down on your rug. Just give me some candy after my hug. Oh, and I'll be there waiting for you. Know that I'll be there waiting for you. Oh,
wise words on the way and music still to come from James here on UK Health Radio. Before we move on, how do you fancy putting yourself in the spotlight? As a therapist, the notion of putting yourself first is a little against the grain, but on this occasion you have the opportunity to showcase your work. Did you know there are over 20,000 registered complementary therapists in the UK, helping people to not only recover from illnesses, but also help focus on long-term well-being? Here at UK Health Radio, we are proud to be the official media partner of the Complementary Therapy Awards 2018. Whether you're an individual or part of a team, you have the opportunity to show the judges how you make a difference to people's lives. For more information, head over to www.complementarytherapyawards.co.uk or on Twitter at Comp Therapy Awards, and that's awards, AWDS. You still have plenty of time to apply, and if you do so before the 2nd of July, your entry is free. Best of luck, and we look forward to seeing you there. Here's a quick question for you. In a world full of social media where tools allow us to connect with each other, no matter where in the world we are, would you say you felt connected or lonely? Recent analysis of 2,000 millennials found that the chance of experiencing depression or anxiety has more than doubled, and this is leading to more young adults experiencing mental health problems. 7% of participants said they regularly felt lonely, whilst almost a third suggested they felt left out and without companionship. And shockingly, for those who identified as being lonely, their chances of being unemployed increased by 38%. These are quite disturbing figures. As a direct result of loneliness, millennials were more likely to take part in high health risk behaviour, whilst also adopting negative coping strategies, contributing to higher chances of poor mental and physical health. Researchers say that findings underscore the importance of early intervention to prevent young adults being locked in a state of loneliness. Such is the importance of combating isolation that the government has introduced a Minister for Loneliness. And with everything that's going on in the world right now, you may have missed this appointment. In a moment, we'll hear from Florence and Alexandra, who have found the perfect way to combat their own loneliness. But first, here's the Prime Minister announcing the creation of a new ministerial position.
In a country of more than 60 million people, and in an age where we can instantly connect with friends, relatives and even strangers around the world, it may seem counterintuitive that any of us could find ourselves feeling lonely. Yet more than 9 million of us say that we always or often feel lonely. 200,000 older people have not had a conversation with a friend or a relative in more than a month. Up to 85% of young adults with disabilities say they feel lonely most days. Loneliness doesn't discriminate. But just as loneliness can affect any of us, so any of us can help to tackle it. We will create a new dedicated fund that will see government working with charities, foundations and others to stimulate innovative solutions, provide seed funding for community initiatives and scale up existing projects. And all this work will be overseen by our new ministerial lead on loneliness, Tracy Crouch. She will be keeping the challenge of tackling loneliness firmly on the agenda of colleagues across Whitehall.
You're listening to UK Health Radio.
I'm Florence. I'm 95 years old, actually sighted, and I have a housemate who is 27 years old.
Hi, I'm Alexandra. I'm 27. I'm a student living in London. I moved here in September and didn't know anybody in London, really.
I wanted to do it because I was very lonely and because I think we all need companionship.
In a way, it was quite frightening because you don't know, are you going to fall? Is something going to happen to you? Also, you're bored to tears. You are used to leading an active life. And suddenly there is nothing. My husband had died, I'm a widow, my children had married and gone away. So it's very important to have somebody coming into the house, somebody to talk to, and instead of sitting here looking at four walls and thinking, what am I going to do now?
I mean, on a completely practical level, it's been important for me as somewhere a way I can come to London and do my studies. But on the other things that I've got out of it that I wasn't necessarily expecting is, you know, I have a new friend, somewhere that I can feel safe and not isolated in a really big city.
I would just call you a friend if anybody asked
good
me.
Friend.
Yeah, I wouldn't say, oh, I'm her home sharer.
You cannot believe the difference that it makes. Just hearing somebody in the house, and to me now, to hear the key in the lock round about 6 o'clock at night is wonderful.
The Mind website has some great information about coping with loneliness, and here are a few pointers to consider. Feeling lonely isn't in itself a mental health problem, but the two are strongly linked. Having a mental health problem increases your chance of feeling lonely, and feeling lonely can have a negative impact on your mental health. Although most people need some kind of social contact to maintain good mental health, everyone has different social needs. You may be someone who is quite content with a few close friends, or you may need a large group of varied acquaintances to feel satisfied. Being alone is not the same as being lonely. There is nothing wrong with being on your own if you are comfortable with it. People usually describe feeling lonely for one of two reasons. Firstly, they simply don't see or talk to anyone very often. And secondly, even though they are surrounded by people, they don't feel understood or cared for. You may feel that you have plenty of connections, but what is actually wrong is that you don't feel close to them, or they don't give you the care and attention you actually need. In this situation, it might help to open up about how you feel to friends and family. It's very hard to stop comparing yourself to others. And we all do it. But it can help just to be aware that things are not always what they seem from the outside. Social media and the fact we're often only seeing what other people want to share about their lives can make us feel like we're the only ones feeling lonely. So it's important to remind yourself that you don't know how people feel when they're alone or when their social media feeds are turned off. For more information, you can check out the Mind website at www.mind.org.uk. That's www.mind.org.uk. Moving on. Having an illness which isn't visible can be a real frustration for people suffering. I suffer from ME, which means I'm exhausted a lot. I'm also in a lot of pain, and that affects my mental health. There are days when I just want to sleep, and I can sleep for up to 18 hours. And even after that duration, I still feel exhausted. As you'll probably imagine, I take a great deal of medication. Whilst that allows me to manage my pain, the side effect is anxiety. I have to balance exhaustion with worry, and ultimately that leads to bouts of depression. But no one can see this. There's no plaster to touch. And more often than not, I do look okay. So trying to articulate the pain, something which is so subjective, can be a real tough task. There's an organisation on the South Coast here in the UK called Root Experience, and they are an arts group challenging people to have more fun through interactive events which empower communities to make positive changes. One of their projects is focused on helping people share the experience of what it's like to live with an illness or condition which can't be seen. It's about replacing loneliness, fear and stigma with compassion, understanding and empowerment. And this is a little like a counsellor's core conditions: congruence, unconditional positive regard and empathy. Did you know that 90% of people who relate to having a disability don't have any visible symptoms? And this can lead to misunderstanding, judgment and isolation. One project called Hidden Stories aims to shine a light on a wide range of emotional and physical struggles that are unseen in communities and to encourage more compassion around them. Hidden Stories is an illustrated book designed to open up conversation and to offer support. The group is hoping for much needed financial support, which will enable them to hold storytelling workshops and work with support groups throughout the South Coast. And once they've published the book, they'll distribute it for free on the Hidden Stories tour.
There's just something missing, but I can't explain what. I have to find it.
I am here because I've suffered all my life with an invisible disability.
I wanted to come onto something where I was the participant and not the facilitator, and I was allowed to be not hiding my disabilities and having to just be okay, but could come and be in touch with actually how tired I was or how upsetting some factors in all of that were for me.
In my case, I wouldn't call it an illness. I think invisibility actually affects me in lots of ways that aren't illnesses. And it's quite often to do with the assumptions that people make about you.
I look fine. I'm not fine because I'm just quite good at managing my symptoms. At the moment, I'm not managing them very well, but when you are managing your symptoms well, people don't necessarily know that you've got any symptoms, and that can be quite frustrating.
I can be the tutor, I can be the poetry performer on the stage, but people don't see the inner self, which is very in contrast to the outside.
At the moment, I just think I'm like a shell. All my insides are gone. And I just want the old Robbie, the content, the happy, the jolly, mischievous person back. And that's how I feel.
My mum and my sister and me in the middle, and so here I try to sum it up by saying, together yet oh so far apart.
It's very consciously a group that's come together to explore invisible disability. So other people are coming with their experiences. This is like consciously experiencing it, and I think being guided to think, well, where is that in your body? How does it really make you feel, instead of covering up a lot of the time?
What's been really good about it is coming together with other people who are creative. Although we are coming together because We see ourselves as having an invisible disability. Actually, we seem to have got beyond the category of disability and we seem to be doing something else. I don't know how that's happened, but by deliberately, in a way, categorising ourselves, we've somehow uncategorised ourselves.
It's about making invisible illness visible, and I think that's really, really important. The school that I'm working in can't see the things that I need, and that's partly because I need to communicate them.
The thing that I absolutely loved was doing the mask work. I felt so much freer and so much more confident when I had one of these masks on. It was incredible. I suddenly became much more confident in my body.
Happily, recently, I've been finding love again, and what they say about love is true. It really can lift you into a place where it becomes possible to achieve a degree of life which hitherto hasn't felt possible.
Doing things is hard work, but I keep doing. Every human being has got difficulties. We're all fighting battles of one sort or another inside.
Find your tribe. Find a tribe to be with. That's the one thing that makes a difference.
Be kind. For everybody is fighting a hard battle which you may know nothing about.
You can find out about the fantastic work and the team behind the Hidden Stories project by logging onto the website www.rootexperience.org/hidden-project. That's www.rootexperience.org/hidden-project. Take a look for yourself. It's really inspiring stuff. This is the Therapy Suite, your dedicated mental health show here on UK Health Radio. Still to come on the show, Deborah McCabe discusses our breathing and wise words on the way from somebody who sold a fair few best-selling books. I'd just also like to mention the latest edition of UK Health Radio's magazine Health Triangle. It's now available to read online at www.ukhealthradio.com. You can find a wealth of information from your favourite presenters here on the station. And take it from me, it's a cracking read.
Stop talking about who's to blame.
James plays on UK Health Radio. You're listening to Duncan Ellison with the Therapy Suite. Before we move on, if you have a mental health story to tell, whether it's your journey or someone close to you, or if you run a mental health project, do get in touch either on Twitter at Duncan_Ellison or email Duncan@thinkduncan.com. I look forward to hearing from you. Here's a quick question for you. How important is breathing? Aside from the obvious answer, of course, have you ever considered how you breathe and the positive impact it can have on your mental state? We welcome back Deborah McCabe to the Therapy Suite this week as she reviews the benefits of considered breathing.
Hello, how's your week been? We saw the sun at last for a few days anyway. Did you enjoy it? Did you feel the warmth of the sun on your face? Did you close your eyes and let your mind and body relax for a while and just be? I hope so. It's important to just be, to just sit a while and let your thoughts come and go without dwelling on anything in particular. One way of doing this with purpose is to reconnect with your breathing. That sounds strange as we are always breathing, but do you actually ever notice your breath? Maybe if you've climbed a steep hill or walked up the stairs, or finishing some physical exercise, you may feel out of breath. You feel it, but otherwise it just gets on with its job of just keeping us alive. It can have another purpose. It can be a very useful tool for calming the mind and learning how to meditate. If you ever find yourself in a stressful situation, or you suffer from anxiety, focusing on the breath is the quickest and easiest way to shift the mind from one place to another. By simply taking a few breaths in through the nose and slowly breathing out through the mouth, you can change the pace and the thoughts going around in your head. If you did this for 2 to 3 minutes, it can totally change the situation, how you feel about it, and how you react to it. I teach my clients to physically say to themselves, I'm breathing in, I'm breathing out, I'm breathing in, I'm breathing out. By talking to themselves, combined with the slow, deep breathing, the thought processes have been changed because the mind is focusing on what you are saying. This can be a really useful thing to do if you have to go into a difficult meeting or an interview, or you want to feel calm and confident, and it can be done anywhere, at any time, No one is going to look at you strangely because you are breathing. It's a really useful thing to do if you have to go into a difficult meeting or an interview and you want to feel calm but confident, and it can be done anywhere at any time. No one is going to look at you strangely because you are breathing. Another useful fact about your breath is that it is always available. You can't forget it, leave it at work or go upstairs, so that it's not something that can be too much effort to do. If you wanted to have a go at a short breathing exercise, I have one on my website, www.meditatetosilence.com. So the next time you can feel something stirring in you that is upsetting, stressful, or making you feel anxious, try breathing deeply and slowly for 3 minutes whilst talking to yourself, and see and feel the difference it has made. The breath is powerful, and so is the mind. Using one can control the other. The next time I will talk about our thoughts. If you want to know more about me and what I do, you can contact me on Deborah@meditatetosilence.com. I would be delighted to hear if anyone did a breathing exercise and it made a difference. Have a good week.
More from Deborah McCabe next time on The Therapy Suite. This is UK Health Radio. My name's Duncan. Hello. I'll bring you a brand new show every 2 weeks. And if you like the show and want more, you can listen to all the different programmes UK Health Radio has to offer. You can choose the Live Play schedule or download your favourite programme on demand wherever and whenever you need to. Before we move on, if you have a mental health story to tell, whether it's your journey or someone close to you, or if you run a mental health project, do get in touch either on Twitter @Duncan_Ellison or email Duncan@thinkduncan.com. This week's wise words are provided by J.K. Rowling. And let's face it, she's written some pretty inspirational stuff. She writes, "Understanding is the first step to acceptance, and only with acceptance can there be recovery." Interesting words to mull over this week. Don't forget, if you do have a mental health concern or have been affected by anything raised on today's programme, please consult your GP or find a counselling service to talk to. You've been listening to The Therapy Suite with me, Duncan Ellison, only on UK Health Radio. Stay well and keep smiling. See you next time.